Hello, and welcome to Behind the Story, a podcast where writers from The Athletic take you into some of their most immersive narrative work. My name is Sean Fitzgerald, and I am senior national writer for The Athletic in Canada. Today, we will be speaking with Dan Robson, head of features for The Athletic Canada, and the story he wrote titled, What Really Happened to Ray Emery? Ray Emery was only 35 years old when he died in July 2018. He was a Stanley Cup champion and a well-liked teammate. He drowned in Hamilton Harbor in what police would later describe as a case of misadventure. Robson spends time carefully retracing what happened that day, and he goes back further and deeper to tell the story of a goaltender who seemed to have it all, only to lose it, regain it, and stand back up on the edge of something new. Dan, welcome to Behind the Story.
Thanks for having me.
This was one of the first stories you published at The Athletic. What drew you to it?
You know, it was the mystery, the initial mystery of what happened in that sort of unfortunate, tragic morning in July when we just all heard the news that Ray had drowned. And I think what drew me to it was that there was very little answers as to what had happened at the time. It was sort of this unsolved mystery that kind of just said, well, he drowned, and everyone kind of just moved on from it. And when I had heard that it happened, I just felt that there was going to be something more there that we should be looking into, but also just being familiar with Ray's life and having followed his career, I always thought that there was something unsaid about who Ray was and sort of what he meant to the game. And I think he was obviously labeled as a complicated figure throughout his career. So I just felt that this was something that if the people who cared about him most, obviously they were going to be going through a great deal of grief, but if they wanted to tell something more about Ray, I wanted to make sure that we gave them the opportunity to do that.
And how did you approach his friends and family, and how did you gain their trust that they'd let you tell his story?
Well, I took some time. I think in a story like this, the impulse to try and get something as quickly as possible is the wrong way to go about it. I think you have to understand grief and understand the human process of how you go through something that is traumatic and shocking. And so I waited for several months, actually. I kind of knew I wanted to do it. I did background research. I figured out what I would need to do in order to get in touch with the right people. But it wasn't probably until October that I reached out to his family through Facebook and through I sort of tracked them down through Facebook and other methods and reached out with sort of a long message explaining what I wanted to do and what I hoped to do with the story about Ray. And it was through that other connections that I had through the world of hockey that kind of knew Ray that I was able to sort of create a. I think a cushion of trust where they said, okay, well, at least sit down with Dan and talk to him and decide if we want to go forward with it. And so it started actually out in Ottawa and chatting with one of Ray's brothers. And from there, and I felt it was essential in a story like this to get to the heart of the story right away and to not try and work around that. So through that, I was able to create a good connection with Ray's family and we worked out from there.
In the end, how many interviews did you do and how many hours would you say that you spent speaking with folks who were close to Ray?
Well, it's interesting because I would say there was sort of two different kinds of interviews. There's sort of the interviews that are the most in-depth and the most important. And I spent a full evening with Ray's family up at their home. And that was probably about 4 hours of just sitting and chatting. And I recorded all of that. So that was all through interview. And then there were subsequent phone calls to sort of follow up with that. So I had lengthy interviews, probably about an hour long with each of his like outside of his parents, his brothers, his grandfather. I spoke with his ex-partner, Keisha Shante, for about 2 hours. And then it was sort of reaching out from there, trying to speak to old teammates and old friends. And I traveled sort of across Ontario, sitting down with people to talk to them. In the end, I'm trying to think about how many hours it must have been, but at least every interview I did was at least half an hour. Some of them stretched on to 2 hours, and there's probably about two dozen interviews or so, ballpark, I would say that we did for the story. So it was extensive. It took a lot of talking, and I think that's important to get to the kind of detail and knowledge you need to tell a story like this. You just have to do a lot of interviewing and make sure that you've asked all the questions that you can ask and that you're asking the right questions.
What was the hardest part for you, maybe personally, in reporting this story?
There were a couple of things. I mean, I think the hardest part probably was that first connection with Ray's parents, going and meeting them up at the lake that they live on, and sitting down with them and sort of having them walk me through their house and showing the different memories of the son who they had just lost. And I mean, it was just emotional. Like it is a difficult thing to experience, because it's not my grief. You're asking someone to open up something that's very painful. And when you're walking through that house, every single object has a memory attached to Ray in some capacity. And you can just walk through it, and they were opening up their world to me and showing it to me. So I felt grief with them. I felt incredibly sad. I felt a great deal of responsibility also at that moment to make sure, I think that was always there, but especially then, to make sure that we got this story right, that we were fair to the memory of who Ray was to them, and also to the complications he dealt with in life, and we're honest and open about that. But I think that night, I remember driving home, you know, it was sort of a 2-hour drive home in the dark, and it was just before Christmas, and it was just a long, sad, quiet drive, and I had 4 hours of conversation, or 5 hours, I think, with his grandfather as well. And just trying to process everything. And it was just emotional. It was just trying to understand the tragedy of a loss of someone who's so young, and had so much life left to give. Obviously, you know, these tragedies happen, but I just felt it very acutely.
You mentioned earlier about wanting very early to get to the heart of the story. Reaching out to one of Ray's family members and wanting to get to the core, sort of the heart. It's a lot to distill in one answer, but what did you arrive at as the heart or the core of the Ray Emery story?
I think that Ray was a person who was constantly at odds with himself, despite his incredible success. Because despite becoming an NHL player and making lots of money and having, you know, sort of what you would perceive as sort of his dream come true, I think that Ray was always sort of fighting, always sort of battling with who he was and what he would be. And I think that, you know, through his career, he had so many ups and downs, and he almost gave it away so many times just by the excess of a lifestyle that was sort of luring him in, that he felt drawn to, that I think made him feel sort of alive and valued. He had lots of friends around, a lot of hangers on from outside the hockey world that were kind of always involved, and he was sort of a superstar, and he enjoyed that. And then that was taken away, and he had to fight so hard to get that back after he had that horrible hip injury that he sort of almost miraculously managed to sketch out a second half to his career and win a Stanley Cup with Chicago, and all these great things were happening. But then all of a sudden, like with most hockey players, with all hockey players, it ends. And I think at the end, he was also then once again grappling with who he was and what he was going to be. And this idea of identity that I think Ray was always battling with sort of goes back to his origins. I mean, to his birth, his mother, Charlene, was just, you know, a hardworking woman who was a single parent. His father abandoned him. He never knew him. And then later on, when he was older, grew up, he had a, you know, his father, his new father adopted him, that his mother married, and that became sort of created this life. But that sort of hole from the very beginning, that sense of abandonment, I think through what Ray wrote, what Ray discussed with friends, I think that sort of affected him for the rest of his life.
Looking back now, do you think that we misunderstood Ray Emery? That a lot of the things, I mean, there are several mentions of headlines during his playing career of, you know, maybe especially in Ottawa, of, you know, events off the ice. You know, mm-hmm. It could be, frankly, I remember a headline of a concert he attended that generated a headline because, you know, he's hanging out with Snoop Dogg, and I think he was wearing a jersey that created a headline or something. Did we misunderstand Ray Emery? And I'm saying we as sort of the general hockey watching public.
I think that there's no doubt that he was misunderstood. I think that there was sort of a, because all of our lives are complicated, and Ray in particular was a complicated guy, there's sort of this surface level, especially in hockey, where it's sort of like, if you're not abiding by sort of the standard code of what we do in the game, and if you're stepping out and creating problems, then you are labeled as a problem person. Then everything that comes after that becomes a headline, and it escalates, and you get a reputation. I think that's sort of a, particularly in hockey culture, maybe in culture at large, but I think Ray, because he was battling certain things, I think that he was just labeled as someone who wasn't grateful for what he had been given and was willing to throw it all away. And I think that there was much more going on under the surface than that. Now, Ray didn't give access to his life, so he didn't explain that very often. So I think that that's one side of it, is that we never really got to see what was going on through Ray, through his own words. But I think when we look at it from the sort of scale, looking back now, sort of stepping out of it and zooming out, and looking at the totality of what we know about Ray, I think it's impossible to say that we had it right. You know, when he was in Ottawa and when he was off in the KHL, when he was doing these things, I think we looked at him as a superficial sort of person. And when you talk to his friends and the people who know him, you talk to guys like Jason Spezza, who knew him since they were, you know, in the minors together, just coming up, and you talk to his friends that knew him in Cayuga that played with him, and it was brothers and his mom and his grandfather, you realize there was so much more to him that we should have known. And it's unfortunate that and it's tragic that the world won't get to know that guy.
There are moments in the story where there's a certain let's say intimate understanding of goalie equipment. How did being a goaltender yourself maybe help understanding the path, and certainly in those early years of Ray's life when money might have been tighter and goalie equipment, mm-hmm. you know, it's not cheap.
Yeah, I mean, so I grew up playing goal in hockey, and I played sort of rep hockey. So I actually traveled a lot of the courses of, I grew up in Brampton, I go out to like Welland and through Hamilton and those areas. So, and speaking with his father, Paul, I learned a lot just when he described the journeys he was taking with his son and getting up in the morning, going to practice and you know, having to scrape money together or fix goalie gear that couldn't be replaced because it was so expensive. All those stories just sort of, they were familiar to me. I'd gone through them myself. I recall, you know, my own dad fixing my own helmet. So when he discussed that, I felt sort of a connection where I felt like I could understand sort of a little bit sort of what their connection was when what they shared in those moments. And I think that, you know, I mean, goaltenders are obviously very misunderstood. It's a very complicated position. So to a certain extent, I do believe I was able to get into a bit of a headspace with them. And one side note, one of the guys that I did speak to through the story, his name is Paul Schalfinder. And he is, I played junior hockey with him in Brampton years ago. And he actually was one of Ray's best friends. And so Paul and I played for a season together, and I followed him, and I knew that he had, when he got off sort of, when we went our separate ways in life, he stayed really close with Ray. And so I was able to sit down with Ray. So as a goalie, in a sense, there was sort of a couple degrees of separation where I think we were able to me and Paul were able to chat, sort of reminisce about stuff, but he had shared all those things with Ray as well. So that was a helpful connection.
Let's go back to the beginning of the piece when you recreated Ray's final moments. I'm curious, how did you find the details? And when you sat down to write them, how did you piece them all together?
So the details I had to be very careful about just making sure that I had as accurate account as I possibly could about what happened that morning. And I think that was key to the story, because I mean, part of the story is exploring Ray's life, but a part of it is also trying to shed light on what happened and how this sort of apparent accident could occur in the early morning on a harbor in Hamilton. So I connected with his friends who had been with him that night. That took a while. I had to sort of work through some different connections there. But I ended up sitting down with two of the guys who were there that morning, and they, you know, just through a sort of a long conversation, walked sort of through what happened the night before, through that morning, up until Ray went in the water and the effort to resuscitate him. One of the guys, his name is Worm. Everyone knew him as Worm. He was living with Ray. He had been in the water and tried to save Ray. So a lot of the account comes from mostly his first person recollection. And he's a guy who's dealt with a lot of trauma going through this still. I mean, he had nightmares after of drowning and had a very intimate conversation with Charlene Ray's mother that I wrote about in the story, in which she, you know, she asked why, like what possibly happened. And, you know, there were no answers, but they embraced and they were able to find some sort of connection to each other. But that story, through the police reports, I went to the harbor myself, took photos of what it looked like, sort of walked in the space where Ray would have walked. So I had, I could see sort of the smokestacks of the steel mills in the distance. That's where Ray's parents had met, where they supported him all the way. And, you know, I thought that was particularly tragic, just seeing sort of the symmetry of where he came from and where he ended, being so close. So seeing it firsthand and then getting as much detail to chronologically just say, this is the story of what happened. This is the best we can know. I mean, I think there's still obviously mystery that's left within it, but I think trying to put the reader there to have a lens on something that otherwise was a complete mystery was important to me.
You mentioned earlier about the responsibility you felt in writing this piece. Did that factor in? Like, is it something that you had to wrestle with every single paragraph and sentence that you are telling the story that is still so very fresh to all of the folks that mm-hmm. you're talking to?
The hardest part for me was just telling an honest story. I mean, I believe I told an honest story, but just that responsibility as a journalist is also, you know, it's paramount. So I couldn't sugarcoat realities of Ray's life. And there were some very difficult moments that Ray went through, and I had to be honest about them and ask tough questions about them. But I found, you know, that people understood that as well. And they knew, I mean, there was, as you mentioned before, there was already sort of a framework of what Ray's life was like. It wasn't that it was unknown, but to go unaddressed, it would have, it just would have been poor in my attempt to have a fulsome account of his life. So, I mean, I had a very difficult conversation with Keisha Shante, his partner, who, you know, had a very tumultuous relationship and a very love-filled relationship that ended really badly. And there had been charges that had occurred. And, you know, we discussed all of that. And I was able, and she was able to sort of give her account of that, which was what was really important to me. So I think that, you know, I mentioned sort of there's that heartbreak with the family and there's that grief and there's this sort of like, you know, I want to tell a story about a great guy, but I also want to tell an honest story about a human being who was great, but also was flawed in many ways. And I think the balance of that was the hardest part of writing the story.
What has the reaction been since the piece is published?
It's been positive. I mean, I think that, you know, from the people that were involved in helping me tell the story, it was positive. I think they believed it was a fair account. They believe that they, from the those that I spoke to, believe that it showed the Ray that they knew within the context of the Ray that everybody else knew. And I think that they felt that was really important. And then I think just publicly, I mean, there was a great reception from our readers and people sort of connecting to a story that they didn't know. And they felt, you know, wow, I had a lot of comments of people saying, I didn't know this about Ray, and I wish that I had known more about this when he was alive. But, you know, it's obviously very helpful to now look at him in a somewhat different light. So that made me feel that I'd accomplished what I'd set out to do.
There's since been a much broader discussion of culture and hockey. From what you learned and from what you've come to know, what role do you think Ray might have played in that discussion today?
I mean, I think that Ray is, I mean, he was this guy that I think it's impossible to not look at some of the framing of the way of his career without looking at it through a racial lens, without looking at the fact that there was this sort of, you know, when he was out partying, that story would get out. When he was out doing things, he was framed as this troublemaker. And although there was never overtly racist language, I think it's fair to look at it and say, well, was there something going on there that within the culture of hockey, a very insular, very white culture of hockey, was he perceived differently because of the color of his skin? Ray himself always tried to push that conversation aside. He didn't like to talk about race. He didn't like to make any sort of a notion that he was being held back. But I think that it was there. And my understanding is that in intimate conversations, you know, he was aware of racism throughout his life and through his career. He had been called names when he was playing junior hockey. That caused some of his fighting that he became very well known for as well. As the culture of hockey, as we start to look at this, examine it more honestly, and we're seeing more stories come out, I think that when we look back, I think Ray's career will fit in as one of the important blocks that we can look back on and say, you know, we needed to change. There needed to be more awareness of these kinds of issues. And we've seen it obviously come out with it, with the revelations of what Akeem Olu has been talking about, for example. You know, as these gets more and more addressed, hopefully we continue to see some change.
Dan, my last question for you is, in the story, Ray's mom was kind of surprised that, you know, when they went through Ray's things, she said that he kept everything, you know, family-wise from you know, souvenirs from his playing days. What are you keeping from this story?
That's a good question. I think what I think of the most from that story is the one moment that Charlene, when she was telling the story of her son passing and like her going through the grief of that and the understanding, going through those things, like feeling, you know, seeing the pucks from his games when he's back in Cayuga and seeing all the things that he kept from his family. When she was showing me this more full picture of a life, and she's looking in the, she told the story of how she took his mask off and put it on her head and put it over her head and looked into a photo of when he's looking through a mask and these sharp eyes that were looking out, and she asked him why this had happened, and she pulled the mask down and she was crying. I just couldn't get that image out of my head, the image of her putting on his mask and trying to find answers and knowing that she never will. The reality is that there is no tidy ending to this story. He died in a tragic accident, and their pain is going to continue on, and that void is going to continue on for the rest of their lives. And I think that just I felt great honor that they had given me a window into what they saw and what they knew, and I think that that understanding, that window, is what I'll carry with me. And I think as I go on in journalism, tell other stories, I think that lesson is something that underpins everything that I focus on, that we never really know the full story. We need to be very cautious about drawing quick conclusions or drawing conclusions from headlines or from incidents. We need to look deeper, and we need to understand that people are layered, and there's much more to these things, and that there's love and hurt and pain and all kinds of things underneath the surface that, as storytellers, I think it's our job to try and bring to light so that we have a more complete picture of the people that we write about.
Dan, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks, man.